Welcome to a fresh new episode of Scoreheads. Yes, that's right. We're back. And within a week. Do you know, Sean, I just literally felt a sudden wave of people having to urgently sit down in shock, disbelief, utter surprise and amazement that I actually managed to get two of these out within a week of each other. And one of those people is probably you, Sean.
I just picked myself up off the floor to be honest, recording. Yeah.
The other one is definitely Paul Marsh. Hello to Paul. Paul. Oh, dear Paul. Paul and I will be back, actually, with We're Going to Need a Bigger Pod very soon, by the way. We do have brand new episodes in the pipeline, so hold tight for those. In the meanwhile, though, get on with the show, man. I can hear you cry. So this week, we continue the tradition of heavy hitters here on Scoreheads with another phenomenal guest. And just to recap who we are and what we do, you're listening to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, and I can also be found as the host of That There Film podcast I just mentioned, We're Going to Need a Bigger Pod, and as the resident film correspondent at Express FM, as well as host of their movie music show, The Composer Series. Joining me is Sean Wilson, who is in fact Sean Wilson and not Michael Caine.
Well, not a lot of people know that. And, you know, this is topical, actually, because with Oppenheimer being out. So every magic trick consists of three parts or acts. The first act is called the pledge. The second act is called the turn. But you wouldn't clap yet, because making something disappear isn't it enough. You've got to bring it back. that's why we have a third act, the hardest part, the one we call the prestige. And I'm getting hairs all about. I'm even in course of doing my own impression, I'm remembering that opening monologue from Michael Caine from The Prestige, which is my favorite Nolan film. I'm thinking, oh, that is just a brilliant scene, a brilliant introductory sequence. But yeah,
world class.
A little bit of a very emotional Michael Caine there for you.
You're not, in fact, Michael Caine though. You are Sean Wilson.
Yes.
Tell us what you do, Sean.
So what do I do? See, I'm getting better at this because this is the part that I'm normally not very good at, talking about myself. I'm more comfortable doing a Michael Caine impression than talking about myself.
And not a lot of people know that.
So I am part-time Michael Caine impressionist, full-time sort of journalist, writer.
And Gaulois smoker. Yeah, exactly. He doesn't smoke, by the way. That's a Desplat reference.
That's becoming a running gag in the intro of these episodes, I think. Yeah, that's going to have to be locked right in. People can go back and listen to a previous one to understand what we mean by that.
Last week's.
But I am the author of The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music from the Silence to the Present Day, and I am a Bristol-based film and soundtrack journalist, contributed to the likes of Cineworld, BBC, Little White Lies, etc., etc. I won't reel them all off because it's tedious. So it's tedious for people listening.
Not at all. Celebrate your achievements, Sean. We've got to lift each other up in this, especially in this world we live in now, this climate we're in. We've got to lift each other up. Anyway, go check him out. He's online. You know, the interweb, that thing the kids use. He's on there, Sean Wilson, at Sean Film Writer on Instagram, and at Sean022 on Twitter, only because I just wrote those things on the internet.
Can I just say, you know, when you described the web as the intraweb, ironically there, and my favourite, do you know Brian Butterfield, the comedy character that Pete Serafinowicz does?
Yes.
The kind of jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
When he recommends people to visit his website, he goes, visit www.com/ Butterfield diet, .com.
Instagram. .com.
There we go. And then at the end he goes, call now, and he doesn't even give you a number.
I bet it starts with 555. On to this week's show. As promised last week, this week's show follows up on our daring ambition to light the fuse on an almost impossible mission. That's right, our mission, should we choose to accept it, was to track down game-changing composer Lorne Balfe and get him to complete a 60-minute debrief on his latest covert operation. Now, it was our reckoning that he would not, in fact, activate Ghost Protocol on us. And so we searched a rogue nation on the hunt for the legendary Lorne, praying that he would join us for a deep dive on his best work to date. Have a great time at that. And, you know, through our persistence, hope that we wouldn't fall out. No?
Nice.
Okay, enough.
Slick.
Enough with the puns. Ethan, I thought they were dad joke worthy. No? Okay. Sean, your favourite Lorne Balfe scores to date, please.
Oh, I just have to recover from that one. I'm really impressed with that. I'm really impressed that he was always in there. Favourite Lorne Balfe score. I mean, Lorne has just, you know, particularly in the last few years, I mean, I loved what he did with His Dark Materials. In fact, he refers to His Dark Materials in the upcoming interview that you're about to hear. I really love that. I really loved his score for Rumble, Black Widow. Yeah, it's just, you know, when you see someone just in ascendance and just getting better and better and better in front of your eyes or in front of your ears, as I suppose I should say. Yeah, Lorne is definitely one of those people. And I was aware going into this that you and Lorne had a correspondence. So I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be an interesting conversation. So, yeah, and it was brilliant. It was really good fun.
Yeah, I'm very honoured and very privileged really to call Lorne a friend of this show and all the shows and all the work I do. Actually, it's not my first rodeo with Balfe boy. This will be Lorne's 6,459th time on it. No, I'm kidding. I love him to bit. He knows it, and it's great. We do have great conversations. I enjoy his company very much, not just during interviews, but also during scoring sessions. Very fortunate to be able to join him whilst he works, and he's been very kind and very supportive of the work that I've done over the years. He's literally the reason the Composer Series exists. Because of him, that is where the seed of that idea came from, because of an interview I did with him. So, and that was thanks to the amazing Beth Krakauer, who is sadly no longer with us, who set us up, got us, introduced us, and so a great friendship was born. This, however, was your first time talking with him, wasn't it?
It was, and it's a long time coming. In fact, that's another thing we refer to when Lorne makes a joke about that in the interview. Yeah, and so there's almost like an arc that kind of, because you and Lorne are obviously both friends, whereas with me it's kind of like, right, I'm going into a conversation with Lorne for the first time. It's kind of like, right, how is this going to play out? And I won't spoil how it goes, but yeah, it's just
I imagine it's like being the new guy that turns up for work drinks and the two new people that you work with are already drunk and start having a deep, meaningful conversation about it. You've just got to kind of jump in and hope for the best.
Can I just elbow my way in?
I think it was always my consciousness in this conversation to make sure that you know, like every one of our conversations, that we have equal airtime, and I hope that we provided the room for that. I think we did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the question, my Mission Impossible was to whittle down my questions that I had, because I had far too many. We had about an hour. I was like, I've got too many questions here. So it's kind of like kill your darlings kind of thing.
It's an hour with Lorne and I as well, which looking. I'm very pleased that you did. Lorne, of course, for anyone listening to the first time, he's done some incredible work over the last few years, as Sean highlighted, across a spectrum of media, including outstanding music for huge IPs such as Assassin's Creed, FIFA and Skylanders in the video game space, a television series such as The Crown, Genius, His Dark Materials, as we talked about, Dope Sick, Wheel of Time, blockbuster movies including Black Adam for DC, Bad Boys for Life, Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves, Black Widow for Marvel, Tetris, Mission Impossible Fallout, Top Gun Maverick, which is one of my all-time faves, and my favorite film of the year so far at the time of recording this, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. What did you think of the film and also the music, Sean?
I really, really enjoyed the movie as a big kind of practical stunt-filled riposte to all the dreary, weightless CG stuff we've had lately, and the idea of Tom Cruise being the auteur of this series, Tom Cruise being the showman who puts himself in these extraordinary situations, and the other actors do it as well, but Tom Cruise is obviously the face of it. And the idea of flying in the face of, you know, studio expectations when green screen and CGI is becoming so much more standardized to a quite depressing effect. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air watching the film, and it's really funny. I think it owes more to the tone of Rogue Nation than it does to Fallout. It's really fizzy and funny in spite of like the world saving stakes in it. And Lorne's score, I think just builds on that Fallout sound with the percussion, with the bongos, with some very, very beautiful writing for strings. We'll get into all of this. I mean, you'll hear it in the interview. But yeah, in terms of Fallout provided a foundation and a very impressive one, this kind of builds on that and it elevates the film. It elevates the dramatic tension of the film in the process, I think, brilliantly.
I think it's his best work to date, as I just highlighted. He's another one, like Ludwig last week, he's another one that goes from strength to strength to strength to strength and just continues to build this empire of symphonies, and it's just wonderful. And Fallout was an absolute knockout for me. I get that I'm a little biased because I got to the sessions and I was in the sessions with him and got to watch some of that score get recorded. McHugh was there as well, Christopher McQuarrie, he was in on the session. It was a great privilege to spend some time with them both and the music team and see how that all worked at Abbey Road. That was for Fallout. This one, Dead Reckoning, oh my word, he has gone above and beyond. And so, Sean and I caught up with Lorne Balfe to discuss his work on the Mission franchise for over an hour. And we have that full uncut conversation here for you right now on this, your latest episode of Scoreheads.
The world is changing. Truth is vanishing. War is coming.
It's been a long time, friend. You've no idea the power I represent. It knows your story. And how it ends.
Listen to me. The world's coming after you.
His fate is written. Shall we write yours too?
If anything happens to them, there's no place that I won't go to kill you. That is written.
All right, so let's light the fuse. Yeah, there we go. I got it.
Yeah, there we go.
Welcome to Scoreheads, if you're listening on Scoreheads, the composer series, if you're listening on Express FM. And if you could be reading this in Film Score Monthly, because apparently it's going there too. So welcome, however you're hearing this or seeing this or reading this. Sean and I are very, 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 very happy to welcome back the one and only Mr. Lorne Balfe.
That's it. Thank you. It could be a long applause. I'll wait.
Do you want me to put an effect under it later? We'll do that.
Settle down.
Composer of what I officially named on the radio on Thursday night as the best film of the year so far, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. It's probably going to be my film of the year, to be honest. But let's get into it. Let's talk about it, because this, for you, this has been 3 years in the making now, is that right?
Sure has.
Yeah, three years and 555 musicians.
Yes. Yeah. No. it has to be 3 years. You know, like everybody, I'm sure we all have lost track of time with COVID. but I'm pretty sure I started before COVID.
Yeah, I think you did.
And then yes, because then we kind of. Then things stopped. I think then we moved on to Top Gun, that little movie that did all right.
Literally rescued cinema.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, it was started three something years ago, and you know, we're very fortunate that we're blessed with one of the most well-known themes of all time. So
there is that, and with one of.
It's a bit easier. I'm not going to say it's totally easy, but it's a blooming icon to have. 3 years, and then six locations recording in, I think.
Awesome.
And then yes, 555, very precise number. Didn't really know it was that many until a couple of weeks ago. When it got added up, but it wasn't meant to be that many. It just happened.
Not all in the same room at the same time, obviously.
No, there would have been fire marshals galore turning up with that one. No, it was spread. We were very much like Pitbull Global, just Yeah, we were everywhere.
Lombau, the pit bull of the film scoring industry. Global, worldwide.
Well, just to say, speaking to you, Lorne, this is kind of like a long-held aspiration of mine, because I've just it's just such a thrill.
You've
to
got
be
low
to...
aspirations, Sean.
You know what? I do. You know what? I'm happy with
God
those
knows
me.
He knows I'm boring, so I wouldn't bother.
No.
The aspiration bar is low, and I'm good with it. But no, it's seriously, it's just thrilling to just be able to talk to you about, like you mentioned there, the Mission Impossible theme, which has got such an astonishing heritage. And like you say, it provides that opportunity for that musical spine. And it's already been, it's been reinvented and reworked so many times. But I really love your loyalty to that theme. And you find different guises for it, which I'm assuming must be part of the whole mission statement of the whole of doing these films, right?
No. You know, I think it's a weird one. You've got, I am of the school of think like the audience. When I go to a movie and it's a franchise and they don't connect us to the themes, I'm seeing the same character, I'm hearing the same story tissue, but you've got an evaded using the themes. I don't get it, and I don't understand why. I sometimes do. I think sometimes there's problems with the studio, that maybe the studio's changed and they don't have the permission to be using it. The music's gone out of publishing. Sometimes they don't want to do it because it means they don't get royalties and they just rather write their own theme. So there's many kind of reasonings to it, but there's no kind of brief about you have to use it, this is what you do. I think it's more about the fact that it warrants it. And I think that Lalo gave us the main theme and he also gave us the plot theme, which is ba-da-da-ba-da-ba-da. And there's just a lot of mileage out of it. And you can cleverly twist it and make it romantic, very much like the opening theme. With this, the whole brief at the beginning really was about trying to kind of go more classical. And McHugh referenced Sibelius and Rachmaninoff and a lot of classical composers and also movies like Ghosts of Mrs. Muir, which Bernard Herrmann did, and that very old school Hollywood sound. And so the DNA is there. Why not use it? The audience connects to it, and it's not part of the contract when signing. I think it's just part of the world. And you sit there and you can, and look, I think I had it on Terminator. Mm. And that was the same process of kind of figuring out, when do you use it? Mm. Don't use it all the time because it just becomes watered down, but use it for a reason, use it for an emotion, use it so that the audience can have fun when something cool is happening, you can have fun with it. And I think, I'm trying to think what other franchises.
Bad Boys was another one.
Bad Boys, you know. Mm. Now, Bad Boys 2 didn't use any of it. Mm. Dramatically. They didn't do it. And dun 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 dun. It's so iconic, and you smile when you hear it. So you have to do it. You have to use it. And I think that there is a lot of mileage in Lalo's original themes to keep reinventing it and finding new ways to kind of use it. So I think you do it so that the audience kind of enjoys it. I think. And Lalo can buy another house.
I was going to ask, actually, I can't remember, we talked about this before, but did McHugh and Tom just basically kind of retain you from Fallout? Were you always going to move on to Dead Reckoning, or was there a break in between and then McHugh came back to you and said, okay, we'd like you to do the next one? How did that process develop?
You never take anything for granted. Mm. So we met for dinner and he told me the story. And I think after an hour, I kind of just said, does this mean I've got a job? Because I didn't really know. So I started then, and then it's phasey because of timelines. I know I went off and did Black Widow, that because we were recording that just when COVID happened. We were the last session at Abbey Road. and then started and then we were on Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And everything shut down. So what that meant was the ability to kind of just purely get extra time to focus on edit and focus on music.
Mm.
It's these things happen, and they kind of tend to happen for a reason. You know, the extra time does really help. But then, yes, you know, I come in it, I come into the world, I do stuff, and then sometimes there's just not much to do because there'll be away filming or something. So, yeah, it's kind of very much kind of on and off. But normally, even when they're editing, we use a great program called Evercast, which is a like Zoom, but it's high definition and it's in Dolby. And most of Top Gun was edited using Evercast, but it means you can log in just like what we're looking at now, but you can see the picture and they can edit. And what we kind of tend to do is just they kind of edit and I log in and then I see what they're doing. And then I'll just get an idea and then start writing. And, you know, I used to be quick. I seem to be getting slower, but I used to be a quick writer. But mainly just kind of write something quickly in a few hours just to get it out, i.e., you know, there was, like in the submarine, there was an original idea about a sonar sound. And I started playing with that, so the pitch of the music did relate to the boom, and then the music worked with the tempo of the solo. But that was an experiment, but it didn't stay. But that experiment happened because whilst they were editing, you're basically in the room, but you're in your lavish recording studio with children running in and out all the time.
But that's cool, though. You get to be a dad and a composer at the same time, right?
The plan changed because of COVID, because my original idea was to build a studio, and I basically dug a basement and built a whole floor, dug down a whole floor. And it was to have additional rooms and possibly, you know, a mix room and everything. It was all going to be music related. And then COVID happened. And the world kind of turned into this, you don't need to go to people's houses any longer. Mm-hmm. You can just log in. And this piece of software doesn't work. Somebody can log in. They can fix it. So you don't need it. So Studio Balf 2 turned into a playroom. And now it just means just a constant running around all the time. But when you're working 20 hours a day, I know some friends of mine that could never cope with having a studio next to the family, but I just know if I don't, I won't see anybody. So it's worked out well, and I've got used to writing whilst Bluey is on in the background very loudly.
I hear it from so many friends. Yeah, Bluey is a major mainstay. They don't have recording studios in their houses, but yeah, Bluey definitely a mainstay. It is a constant thread. Yeah, I mean, there's been so much with the film. Like you said, it's taken 3 years, this whole process. With the film now being out, there's been such a kind of visceral reaction to watching Tom Cruise doing this stuff again, like a jaw-dropping effect. And I wondered, when you were on the process of scoring the movie, what were your initial like visceral reactions to seeing him doing this kind of stuff? Was that kind of parlayed in the music in any way? Did it help shape it?
Yes. You know, it always does. It's Tom Cruise. You know, I think you always pinch yourself because you basically, there's not many movie stars left. Real big movie stars that we're not seeing all the time, whether they're on television or they're in TV shows. You know, there's a select few. So you internally acknowledge that because it's as big as it gets.
Yeah.
So you know it's got to be epic, and you know it's got to be. But I think more importantly, I think the progression of Ethan has been, I think, you know, it's down to McHugh and Tom's relationship, really, that there's been a different side to Ethan Hunt that hasn't been in the other movies. And I think it's really been becoming more of an emotional journey and inner soul-searching situation. So that is making this music discovery even more complex but more deep because of those performances. You know, you watch it and Cruise's performance in it is better than all of the others. It's you know, he just gets better and better. So that just can only give you inspiration. It's a tricky one because the thing is that it's, I think when writing for music, I think you can only be as good as what the film is. And sometimes if the film is bad, you have to challenge yourself and just go, I'm going to try to make music as good as possible to kind of overshadow it somehow. You know, it's like a magic trick. You're trying to kind of, but you know, with this, you don't have that. And you've just simply just got the best filmmakers, the best actors and actresses, the best editors. You've got the best, you know, every head of department is the best on a film like this. It's your A grade right from the start. It's the same with the music department. You know, I think you just see one name credited, but you've got it's a big team on a movie like this. I think there's 550 musicians, but I think there was about 240 in the music team. A lot of people, and their names aren't always at the end, but yeah, they are all the A team also, and it's a. When you watch those sequences, you can only but get inspired by it because they are visually amazing. And you know, the motorcycle jump, it's just...
Just going back to what you were saying there, obviously you don't have to name the director or the movie and I wouldn't ask you to, but have there been... Because we've had this in conversations with other artists where someone has literally come to them with a scene, I need you to save this scene with music. Have you ever had that before as an experience?
Yes. It's not a bad thing. I think sometimes they just didn't get the performance or sometimes the emotion wasn't... Now, when everything comes together, it's just not right. There's so many, the pressure on filmmakers now, the concept of test screenings happens so much. And that can dictate a lot of things. Sometimes the audience will be telling you that there is no chemistry there. There is no love connection. They're just not. And that there's no one to be blame for that. It just makes something just not happen. So you have to kind of, you have to have that big spoon of
inspiration
and help, you know, it's tastes and it's trends. When I'm working on a kind of an independent film, sometimes you can be more risky and let the emotion play, and you don't need to accompany every movement. He's going out for a kiss and he's getting what, you know, you don't have to score every moment. And then sometimes the bigger Hollywood movies, you do, because you know that every emotion and sense has to be ticked in that environment, needs to be absorbed. So it happens a lot. And sometimes, yeah, on that day, the chemistry didn't work. So can you help? And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that it's just tricky sometimes when you're forcing the audience and they know, they're like, yeah. You're being sappy now. Stop it.
One of the elements of the Dead Reckoning Part 1 score that I really, really loved was the theme, or I don't know if theme is wrong, the suggestion, the motif for the entity. Now, I'm going to expose my lack of musical knowledge there. I didn't know if it was like a semitonal kind of development with that suggesting the all-encompassing AI in the background, which I thought was brilliant, and that's obviously pervasive. Because it's supposed to be, because the enemy is pervasive, right?
Yeah, well, it's related to the plot theme. And it's the same as Grace's theme is the plot theme. It's about trying to take... It's trying to connect these things, and Grace's theme is the plot theme, but on top of Ethan's chords. And Ethan's chords are kind of originates from Fallout, but again was just trying to kind of find something that kind of works for his performance, and it's just not too over the top. You get the sense of a journey, you get a sense of a backstory and a history. So everything does start kind of becoming a puzzle and it all connects. And again, it's not really a rule. It's just what kind of t- tends to happen.
Hmm.
And it was very much the same on Top Gun, with taking Danger Zone, and that then starts sprinkling itself throughout the film, with Dark Star. Mm. That there's hints of the main theme on top of it, the da dee da 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 da, but we never kind of go that far. It's just ba dee da.
Yeah,
you know, it's as triumphant as you can get.
Mm.
It's just about trying to kind of hold the hand of the audience musically, and they know that they've heard this before, but it's just tiny bits constantly dripping into their ears.
We talked before about how that when you started on this, first of all, you were kind of writing to script and story, weren't you? Is that how the journey began on Dead Reckoning, and then you started to kind of evolve it once pictures started coming through? How did it work?
No. It's interesting. If you follow McHugh's Instagram, you'll see sometimes that he, and again, you go back to the timeline and you'll see he'll have bits of script and there'll be dialogue on it or directions. That's what he would send to me. And I would start, oh, okay. I'd start writing something based around that. Or when they were filming, the great sequence in the beginning with all the typewriters, that when they were filming that, he just took some photographs of it and sent it to me. And it was just like, when do they make movies like this now? They just don't. That shot alone deserves its own movie.
Mm.
Thought very like Kafkaesque, or very like George Orwell, kind of very interesting, very compositionally interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And very real. It can only bring inspiration. So you see something like that as a photograph and you get you get inspiration from it. And the same when he's writing dialogue, he would send pages or not pages, paragraphs or top lines or something. And that would bring the kind of the inspiration to get writing then instead of at the end when it's a mad panic. If you've got the luxury to start early, then go for it. You can create your own temp. And when you do that, you create your own sound for the film. So it really is about things like that, visiting set, seeing locations. That all starts bringing the inspiration so you can start writing.
Is having more time, artistically speaking, we could always use more time, right? But sometimes is it good to have more time?
Depends.
Or sometimes is it better to be kind of like, I only have this much time, I need to just do my best? Because sometimes you do your best work, not literally you personally, but some people do their best work when they're like, you have a finite amount of time, just you haven't got time to think, you know, what's better for you?
I don't know, because it's a losing battle, isn't it? If you boast that you did something in 2 weeks, somebody will turn around and said you should have done it in three.
it's like a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
So you can't, it's very difficult to kind of look at it and kind of go, well, I think sometimes you don't necessarily work as hard if you've got a long time. I think what you do, though, is you have time to think and process. And I think that's the useful thing. And that's a luxury with time, is to be able to step back and just sit and kind of go, oh, I don't need to panic about writing something today. I could just kind of focus on 5 seconds where you don't get that. You know, sometimes in some movies you get, you know, I come in and it's like 2-3 weeks. With a situation like that, you just stick to your guns, and what you start with is what you finish with.
Hmm.
You go straight into it and you own that theme or you own that concept, and you don't let go of it. You don't have time for doubt.
Hmm.
And I think that when you do have time, you sit and sometimes maybe it's for the best. Who knows? It's the same as bands.
Hmm.
You know, when you hear Blue Nile did Hats, and they spent like, I don't know, was it 5 years?
Maybe.
Doing that album? I can't remember. Yeah.
Something
the album
like that,
is one of the best albums ever, correct. But could they have done it in 6 months? Who knows?
Hmm.
So yes, I think it's you know, I had totally forgotten this, but I was thinking about it recently. I was doing, when I was doing Dark Materials, I was about to, I had to go and pitch the following day the concept of what the opening theme was going to be. And I had two or three ideas. And then that, and then the night before, I just thought, oh no, I probably, I'm going to try something else. So I did it in a couple of hours. And that's not, I don't think, as proud of it. It was just a case of, I probably spent 2-3 months subconsciously thinking about this other director, but I just didn't do it. So I did the groundwork, and then it was just like, now this is do it. And that was the one that got chosen. But I think it's like all of it. I think we need deadlines to kind of, to know when to finish things. But I don't know. I'm not too sure if I do a better job with a lot of time or less. I know I enjoy tight deadlines. Very perversely, I do. It's like, you know, it's like the phone goes and you kind of go, it's Christmas Eve. Yes, we can do it. And, you know, and it is a little bit like the A-Team. You know, you phone the gang and it's like, we're going to get this done. 2 weeks, let's go. So I don't know, but I know that the older I'm getting, the more I'm enjoying time to sit and focus on melodies.
Mm.
Not rush and not feel sick that I'm only getting 3 hours sleep. Mm. You know, you're just able to come in and out and slowly try to write it. But it's a luxury, but it can be the devil, I think, sometimes. It's, when do you stop?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I wondered, given you work with McKee, with Chris McQuarrie before on Fallout, is there also a luxury of knowing that you've worked with this filmmaker, and do you have like a shorthand in terms of spotting the music or having ideas? Are there like lots of conversations that come out just talking about the music in general and talking about the approach for the film?
There's a lot of talking. There's no shorthand. You know, I've got a good shorthand with Michael Bay. Or it's good.
Well, at least it's honest.
Totally.
Is it just a text that says this is is that it? Like
I think there's no shorthand, because, you know, with Michael, I think it's actually, look, he is, him and Jerry are the reason why we're talking. You know, they made films and why I wanted to get into films. So Michael knows action music, and I think that when I give him something and he's kind of, you know, he knows it. He knows that he's heard it before, something. So he switches, it's like, you can do better. And it's like, uh-huh, okay. And so there's a shorthand there, but I think there, I don't find shorthands with many people. They're always wanting they want to reinvent things. They want to try something new. I think the shorthand from experience tends to be something where it's predictable. Like, oh, well, this formula works, let's stick to that. And I'm lucky that everybody that I work with do want to try to push things and change things. And I think that you get people's tastes, that's for sure. You kind of understand how they like to work with dialogue and sound effects and things, but I think that no day is the same.
Who would you say, actually talking about that, who would you say, in a positive way, who would you say was the filmmaker that you would say had pushed you the hardest in a positive way and kind of forced you to grow and develop?
Hans.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, you know, it's like filmmakers that kind of, you work with and you know, like Jerry pushes me to make sure that every film that we work on has got a unique identity to it. And he lives and breathes movies. And again, he is the reason why that I got into movies. When you see that Simpson Bruckheimer tree.
And yeah, the lightning.
At the beginning of any film.
Goosebumps. Like, yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Here we go. And it's the same, you know, when it comes on TV and you see that, you're waiting to see what it's going to be. And then it's like, yeah. I'll
The Rock.
Oh, yes.
We have a thing. I always text like when The Rock's on. I was like, look, yeah, yeah. The Rock's on. Or he'll text me and it's like, The Rock's on.
Yeah, Channel 5 have got a monopoly, I think. They just see
I've literally got every version of it. And yet when it's on television, There it is. You watch it.
I know. I had the best education. It's the only way I can look at it that way, because I did get to work with the best filmmakers living through Hats.
Mm.
I'd sit in a room and I didn't have the pressure of being in that seat.
Mm.
I just got to sit in the back and see how to communicate and work with the likes of Chris Nolan and Ron Howard and Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay, you know, because they all had relationships with. So it was that. It was about storytelling. Very little time was spent analyzing what the chord progression was and if it was a diminished seventh or it was about filmmaking. So, and it was, you know, 15 years. It was a long apprenticeship, but it was all these experiences that went into it. And I saw the business side and I saw the creative side, and you saw that kind of things, what you were talking about can you make the scene better or something. You saw a lot of the time it wasn't about the music.
Hmm.
That wasn't the problem. It's something else. And that's very common with when people get fired. It's very little to do with the music sometimes, you know, because they were good enough to get the job.
Mm-hmm.
But they got the job. Something else happens. And it's normally diet, communication, or stuck in your own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact is that the storytelling part of the film can change. And if you can't follow the change and you're still stuck in how you believe it is, it doesn't work. You have to keep evolving and changing. So, long story, Hans Zimmer.
Hmm.
I just wanted to circle back, Lorne, to Mission Possible, because I know you tweeted out about the top secret drum call that
you used. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, which is, well, how do they get, what was the nature behind that? How do they get involved?
Yeah, I wish I could take credit for that. Tom and McHugh had seen them at the Queen's Jubilee.
Ah.
And had talked about it, but it hadn't really got anything to do with it. They had been watching it on YouTube, and I think I then started thinking about it. I thought that would be an interesting new element to it. We did the bongo adventure on Fallout.
Mm-hmm.
We still did the adventure on this one, so that was all right.
Family adventure.
Yes, yeah, no, I did, and yes, yeah, my mother, I was really shocked. My mother used to be a military, she used to play the pipe band, and I didn't know that. She's 80, but I didn't know she used to play, and at the session, she picked up some drumsticks, and there was a snare. She started doing the pipe band drumming. I never knew it in my life. Anyway, but no, McHugh played, Eddie Hamilton played, Cecile, music editor, also played. I played, but yes, we knew the bongo thing was kind of there, but the drum thing, and then I just thought, okay, and it weirdly just changed the way of writing. So then I started writing a piece called Mission Conclusive, which was a suite, but I started thinking about, oh, orchestra with military drums, and the fact that visually you see how they work. It's not just, it is one tone, da 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 da, but it's a da da. And that kind of led into a kind of a different way of writing. And again, it was only a couple of months before the end. So it was again a new kind of a new idea that then changed the tone of the music. It wasn't just a case of just whacking them on top. It changed the concept. And of course, the bongos, that leads me perfectly into, we're doing a charitable auction for the Highland Hospital, the Highland Hospice, and bongos. One of the sets that we used to play on in the film, all the players signed it, and then also the score is signed by all the musicians and the director and editor. So that's on the highlandhospice.com website.
Mm-hmm.
Raising for a good cause.
Mm.
But no, I think it was, working on films like this is a luxury. You know, you work on other projects sometimes where you know, you can't, there's no budget to record five musicians, let alone 500. So doing this kind of really opens your imagination and the concept of what you can be trying. And involving them, that was just yet again this ability to kind of, right, where are they? And they're not professional musicians either. They're lawyers, they're doctors, they're accountants, they've got day jobs. So they do this on the side. But yeah, getting them involved then did open it up into this different kind of, oh, we can be trying something different now. We could be trying, you know, more rhythm based, more percussive based. So that was the connection, the Queen.
Yeah.
What was the most eye-opening thing about, for you, for working on Dead Reckoning? Because we talked before about Fallout, about how, you know, that was quite a, it was a new experience, I guess, but it was your first mission, so everything was kind of new and fresh, and it was very eye-opening. But with Dead Reckoning, going through this process over the last 3 years, what was the most eye-opening or the most, you know, game-changing experience for you throughout this process that kind of made you go, we're moving up with this one? This one is...
Ask me at the end of the year.
Still going to let time to have it resonate, right?
Yeah, because I think the tricky thing is that it really is bigger than one person.
Mm.
And I think we had a big music team on it. That big music team had to sit there. It had to be there to make it possible. I think there's a trend sometimes where people kind of act like they're singular, the Lone Rangers, and they mm-hmm. do it all themselves. And you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
Politely, you're lying.
Yes.
But because, and I think sometimes, especially with the film music community, you'll see that it's, they don't, people kind of judge people. Oh, well, you've got additional composers. You've got da 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 da. And it's not about, you need that on these big budget movies. You wouldn't survive a day if you don't have that infrastructure around you.
Mm.
When you finish, by the time you finish writing a cue, they've already cut that cue, and it's a different, it's in a different structure. So people need to kind of do it. And also you hit a wall sometimes and get stuck and go, I need a break. I don't know what to do here. And you kind of have to rely, you know, base yourself with people that kind of the same way as I was brought up and trained under Hans, was that sense of a band. And that, you know, if you were stuck with something, you can talk to somebody, or somebody all of a sudden is going to come with a far better idea than yours.
Hmm.
And you go, that's how you do it. You know, I think there was a whole thing going on about ghostwriters and things. And I know I've never been brought up around ghostwriters. They're called additional composers and they're credited. Mm-hmm. But I hear about it.
Hmm.
But you definitely... It is definitely the bigger the budget, the more the pressure, and the more important it is about the team and how you manage it. It's weird. It's not just about writing a good theme any longer. That if you want to do that, then maybe go and write for the concert hall. This is more now about the same. We are a department. It's the same as a VFX department, the same as a da-da-da-da. You know, it is a department. Whether you like it or not, and the purists don't, it's you know, bad luck. That is it. And I think we've got to be more vocal about giving people credit. We've got to be more vocal about, because it's the only way you're going to get new talent coming through that are properly prepared for it, and they're not just being thrown into it and given a job. It's just, it can't work that way. There's my union, my potential composers guild speech.
Well, there's that story, isn't there, that with when Max Steiner was writing the score for Gone with the Wind, that David O. Selznick was just so demanding that Max Steiner had to bring in other orchestrators. He had to bring in other people to help him get him over the line. And it's kind of like, that was part of the fabric of that score. And that's just it, isn't it? And that was way back in like the end of the 1930s, you know, when the Golden Age was just getting off the ground.
No, and I think it's the same as, you know, record production. You some people will have five or six different drummers come in and they'll just use different takes, or they want to try a different approach or something. Same with different, you know, session musicians. They come in and it's no different than a VFX team. There has to be a leader. There has to be somebody that creates the template. There has to be something that creates the template of that dinosaur and how it's meant to look and how it moves. It is a team effort, and I've been posting every day every single member's name involved with this project, you know, down from all the musicians, but also the music team, you know, every copyist that's been part of it, every orchestrator, every sound designer we've had, just because I think that it will further their careers and also legitimize it.
I want to just go back to, before we go, because I know I do definitely want to mention this. We want to talk about, because lots of people are still yet to see the movie, so we'll just kind of refer to it as that bridge scene. We need to talk about that bridge scene. We need to talk about that. We need to talk about the music, not just in that particular pivotal moment, but also the music that builds up to it. It's also beautifully, perfectly structured and put together. Talk about inspirations behind that and how you arrived at that music as the, you know, the final cue for that scene. Because I think it's just phenomenal.
It's straightforwardly down to many people. And, you know, let's go to the beginning. The concept of sweets, the concept of music not being written to picture. That sits in a bin. They're editing. They're able to take it. See, does it work? It doesn't work. Try a different piece of music. It doesn't work. It might work. We've touched on it before, but the whole concept of a music editor is a kind of a job that just doesn't really get mentioned enough. Most of Bay's films, Mike always uses Alex Gibson, and Alex also does Chris Nolan's movies. And there's a very unique way of working there that's just so different than a composer would. And it's taking stems and it's creating music with stems. And it's creating music where you don't look at it as music, you're looking at it as this timeline where you're doing different emotional beats and coming in, coming out. That kind of concept was used for some of it. And Cecile and Eddie and Chris, really, there was a lot of back and forth. We're taking pre-existing suites. Sometimes it works, then it has to get crafted. And then a lot of the team trying to kind of, I think the end of the train, I think I wrote that maybe three or four times. And I know the team, I know that Kevin was on it, Max was it, Stu, you know, I'm going to just list every name of additional composers. Stu had a go at it. It's something where I don't know how anybody would sit down and write from scratch. It's just too, you know, that sequence is its own movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
for sure. for sure.
You know, and I think another complicated scene was the going over the cliff.
The motorcycle scene, or the train.
The motorcycle.
Yeah.
It again was many attempts at that, and it not working straight. It is very difficult because also the picture will change. So sometimes the concept changes of what the emotional journey is of that scene. So the music can't work. So I wish I could tell you, John, that on Monday it was written straightforward It was a very complicated sequence that alone probably could have been an hour and a half. So it just kept evolving, and also I think it's about trying to it kept changing every time we went back and had an audience preview of it, because then you'd sit back sometimes and go, it's too repetitive.
Yeah.
It's music we've heard too often here. We've heard this theme has been used it. So you then have to start again. It's not just like sitting and watching. I've noticed some of the streamers are now doing movies under an hour now. It's very straightforward. Just
it's a movie you watch in 85 minutes.
Yeah, it's something. Yeah. So you have to kind of step back and look at the bigger thing and go, yeah, there's repetition now. So we have to change this and fix this and start again. So, but you know what? It's the same. Same as the end credits. I think version 45 was what we recorded.
Oh, wow.
And there's evolving for certain, you know, different reasons. That always a way that it can be maybe a bit more fun sounding. You try different orchestration, and then that doesn't work after what you've come from. So it's a lot of. I probably put myself out of a job by saying that it's trial and error, but it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Artistically, of course it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you hear when. I've been listening to this great podcast with Kemp and Guy Pratt, Rocketeers, I think.
Not sure.
But they interview people, and they're Thomas Dolby and Mark Knopf. Just tons of people, and talk about the process of creating albums. And it's interesting. You don't set out with a plan. There has to be mistakes, and there has to be discoveries, and unless you're very lucky, like Elton John with Your Song, where you wrote it in two. The story is he wrote it in 2 minutes.
I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard.
What a song!
2:30 though. That's the problem. So I don't hear that one. But you know what I mean. It takes a long time to get there, and I think you can figure out shortcuts. Of course, there are ways and. We've kind of touched on it before in regards to when you only have 2-3 weeks to do something, you can figure out a formula about, focus on these things and these emotions, and you can work that way. Yeah. Did that answer your question? That's a long-winded answer to it. Sorry.
It's a good answer.
You switched off. You switched off with that one. It's also like, you know, it's the concept of also... And it's something that I was reading about a couple of days ago because somebody was moaning about the length of the album. And it's an interesting concept because some people want all the tracks.
I'm that guy.
You see, but then somebody just wants the best of.
Yeah, the curated highlights. Yeah.
And you're never going to win.
No, it's a journey, though. It's a journey. Sean, did you have one last question?
I was going to say that the score is fantastic, and actually, kind of wrapping it up by returning to the motorbike cliff sequence, because that's the most famous sequence. It's going to go down as probably the most famous sequence in the film. And I just think that the punctuation of the score aligned with the physical movement of Tom Cruise and the other actors in it. I mean, that sequence is kind of... It's, to my impression, the music in that kind of is gracious enough to kind of give... audio space to the physicality of the stunt, like the idea of you get the expanse of him going off the cliff and then the music kind of sort of fades. Is that something that arises organically? I imagine that arises out of like many different attempts, right?
No, you know, it's a great example in McHugh's taste in using music. It's like in Fallout, I still think it's one of the best action sequences ever. Is the fight in the loo? There's no score in it.
just the sound of punches and lots of
shotgun arms.
It would be great if there was music in it because you see, this is why it's so great. But the amazing taste is when and when not to do music. I think the audience gets exhausted by. Fighting between sound effects and fighting between score sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think he has always got a very clear plan about when there's score and when there's not. And like that, I think the way that he had structured the temp with Eddie was when that happened, it did. God, you know, again, I wish I could say it was like when I had to do the narration,
The DVD commentary.
The commentary of the DVD of Fallout. And it was just like every great decision there, none of it was mine. It was like, yes, no, Eddie actually took this piece and put it here. And then it was like, oh, no, Cecile took this and put it there and then they cut that. But no, it is that. It's choosing when and when not to. And I think that is a hard thing, especially for composers, because I think they... I personally think less is way more. I don't want to not end up with music in the film, but sometimes I do sit there. If it works, you know, you kind of also it changes the tone. Sometimes with action sequences, It can change, you know, you can maybe make it more fake by adding music to it. But I think Chris has got a very particular taste and style of music, and what the audience is wanting, and whether, you know, sometimes it's, especially with this film, there's more fun in it.
Mm.
There's more fun and humour than in Fallout.
Yeah. Mm.
So I think that pulling music out also helps with that.
For those that are still yet to see Dead Reckoning, I mean, for those of us that have seen it many times, but for those that...
How many times have you seen it, John?
Three now.
Well, is that all? Sean?
Is that all?
Well, I'm going to come across as the fool now. I only saw it once at a preview because I'm struggling to fill it in again. But I will.
I've done it three times.
It's not a competition.
Just a little bit. He'll catch up.
It was a very, very special screening. It was very good. I mean, the audience was palpably, viscerally involved, aided immeasurably by the music. I mean, again, during the motorbike sequence,
we were at the Odeon, yeah, the Leicester Square, with the because you were at the back, weren't you? And you,
oh,
we
I was,
did the,
I was at the back, yeah.
The
yeah.
collective yeah. sigh in the train sequence, the whole room just went,
yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
You know, it's like I always remember going to Leicester Square, the Odeon, to see Signs. No, not Signs. I See Dead People.
Sixth Sense.
Yeah. And you felt it go all the way, you know, at the end. You felt the whole going, I travelled all the way back. And I was in the cheap seats right at the back. And it just... if one thing COVID has taught us is that you need that environment.
Mm.
Because I remember when we were knee deep in COVID, and I remember kind of thinking, gosh, you know, there's nobody talking, there's no sound of popcorn. I can just sit in the studio and watch a great movie, and it's great. And you were like, nobody laughed.
Yeah, yeah. It's you are reliant on that physical interaction with other people, that awareness of other people in that space. Yeah.
Yes, and also I see it mainly now because of children, so we go to a lot of children movies, and it's the same. You see their body language; they all collectively enjoy it, and so we know that we're safe for that generation are going to keep going. But no, it's the cinema is a very unique and essential part of escapism, I think, for all of us.
And Mission Impossible. Definitely has that. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, it's in cinemas now. Go for that collective experience. It is awesome. I'm going to go and see it many, many more times. If you're listening, you should go and see it too, because I think it is film of the year so far. We did this with Top Gun Maverick, didn't we? You guys keep churning them out. Churn them out. Lord Balf, thank you so, so much, sir. It's been a privilege to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure, John. Sean, I hope I lived up to your...
Well, yes, you did, yeah. Yes, that was an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Sean. I'm always really, really so interested to delve into the process behind a film as gargantuan as this. It's always a really eye-opening experience having discussions like this. So, yes, more than exceeded expectations.
Good. Now, you know, the thing is also, I think it's about kind of, I think sometimes because we do so much, you kind of take for granted these situations. And it's like, I've been trying to kind of get students to come to sessions now to try to kind of firstly get them to understand the importance of live musicians, which is kind of shocking. A lot don't understand how great a live musician is. But it's also just to remove a bit of the mist and mirrors around it and see the whole filmmaking process. So if you're in London, John, I'm always trying to invite John, but something happens that he's going to go and see the Avengers or something.
No. Not last time. Last time that we tried and you guys were like, oh no, you can't come.
Well, no, because we were still doing COVID protocol.
Yeah, that was it. No, I remember that.
Yeah.
It was logging into Zoom.
Yeah, we'll come.
Oh,
we'll
exciting!
Come, we'll come to the next one.
Just Monday. I'm doing something on Monday.
Are you doing something on Monday? I'm not in town on Monday. That's too quick. Sean, you should go.
Recording Argyle.
Oh, I'm being thrown with an opportunity.
I know you don't have the answer now. For goodness. No, but I'm recording Matthew Vaughan's new movie, Argyle.
There you go.
Oh yes, yeah. I will bear it in mind.
Break. No, no, because my brain goes, right, I'm going. And then I'm like, no, you can't, because you've got this thing.
John's not.
If I swap this around, cancel that. Yeah.
I'm actually, you can see the culture. It's like man works thing out on podcast.
If you look at our videos, the minute Lorne said, why didn't you come Monday, you see that we both collectively went, Amazing. Lorne, thank you so much. Sean, thank you so much.
Thanks,
all the best of Argyle.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you both for your time. Thank you.
Take care, my friend. Thank you.
Ethan, what's your objective? What's your ultimate objective?
Your life will always matter more to me than my own.
None of our lives can matter more than this mission.
I don't accept that.
Composer Lorne Balfe there. Very generous with his time. He's always very generous with his time, actually. I'm so, as I've said many, many times throughout this podcast, it's a real privilege to be able to have a line of correspondence with him more often than, as you probably picked up from that interview, we literally text each other about all kinds of random things, movie-related, of course, or music-related, of course. It's usually me texting him to say how amazing I think something is that he's done. But a really, really great chat with him. Offered some real great insights there. How are you feeling after your first chat with Lorne?
Well, I think we heard how positively it resolved itself, didn't it? I'm on cloud nine listening to that again, and I think we covered an extraordinary breadth of topics, ranging from, you know, the use of the Mission Impossible theme to the construction of the Dead Reckoning Part One score itself, to the very, very interesting talk about industrial practices, which was that's always fascinating when he got onto the topic of ghostwriters and how that is often seized upon as a kind of feverish topic online. That was very, very interesting to hear him address that in a wider industrial sense. Yeah, really, really, really thrilled. It was a really fun interview, I think.
He's so much fun as well. I do enjoy spending time with him. He's just absolutely brilliant. So, such a positive force as well. And I can tell you many great stories of how brilliant he is with his team. He's very much, it's funny, we talk about people like Christopher Nolan and Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie having command of their set, but they're also recognised as good leaders, good bosses, good filmmakers. Lorne's the same in terms of the music department. You know, Lorne, and I get that he's learned, he's had a great teacher, right? But I get that he's learned a lot from Hans as well, in that he's trying to build a band. You know, he's always, and his way that he credits everybody for everything all of the time. I've watched him in sessions and he'll go around and talk to every single musician on his lunch break. You know, that's who Lorne is. So that great. I honestly, a real, real thrill and a real privilege. Dead Reckoning is by far and away my favourite Mission soundtrack, because I just think it builds on the work that he did in Fallout, certainly. And yeah, if you want to see the movie, it's in cinemas right now. Do go and check it out. Cinemas and theatres, if you're listening overseas. Do go and check it out. If you haven't seen it yet, honestly, it's a real, real thrill ride. It's what cinema is about. And it's such a great story. Every element and every ounce of this picture for me is perfect. And I just think that, and the practicality of it as well. It's great storytelling. It's great writing. It's great filmmaking. Great music. I just, yeah, my film of the year so far. That Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part One, that is in cinemas now. The music is currently available from our friends at Sony Classical. There is a plan for a 2-CD release as well, and even a vinyl release, I think, is coming on from various platforms. But you can currently get the digital album from Sony Classical, available on all good digital retailers. And just a quick thank you to our friends at Paramount, here in the UK. Made sure we saw the film before it was released, which is great. I do want to thank Vue as well, because they let me go and watch it again right before I talked to Lorne, just so I had a kind of a recap and a refresh. So thank you to them. MyVue.com is the nearest, or is the nearest place you can go. Yeah, sure, go to myview.com and you'll find your nearest view right there. Thank you very much to them for all their help and support in making me just rock up one morning or afternoon and go, can I watch this again, because I've got an interview later and I kind of want to swat it. Yeah, no problem, they just let me in. They're so cool and I love them very, very much. Well, I will say thank you to the Odeon in Leicester Square for being excellent hosts, though, for our original
Screening. I'll echo that sentiment, because that was a spectacular screening. That was
it
rectified brilliantly, and the audience was so into it. We heard, mentioned in the interview there, you know, the cutting of the music around the now notorious bike sequence. Everyone kind of inhaled.
inhaled, then exhaled. I know, I love that. It was really, really cool. Really, really happy with the movie, with the score, with our chat. And again, thank you to everybody involved in, as we say, it takes a village to make a podcast. So thank you to you, Sean. Also, thank you to Lorne's team. And thank Ashley and Ruth and everybody in Lorne's team. Also, the team at White Bear who helped bring this together as well, to Chandler and Kiri and all our friends at White Bear who look after Lorne's publicity and have done an excellent job, as always, in making sure we had this locked into place all in good time. I think that I thanked everybody. I think that's everybody. I want to say hello.
Acceptance speech.
Yeah, no, I want to say hello to Karen at Sony Classical as well, because she really does look out for us.
So, thank you, Karen. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you too. Echo that sentiment. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks to Karen. She's done an amazing job making sure we had album files and stuff ready so we could just gorge on the score like a week before we spoke to Lorne, which was really cool.
Oh, did I seize on that when we were sent it prizes? I was like, oh, yes. It's a real privilege to be able to be sent this kind of artistry before it goes on wide release, so you get to hear it before and you get to formulate your own opinion before it kind of goes on mass release. That's a real privilege for people in our position to be able to do that, I think. So thank you to everyone who made that possible.
And the movie and the album. We were very lucky with this one. So thank you for listening. If you want to check us out online, I'm at John Brown TV. That's at J-O-N Brown TV. At John Brown TV on all platforms. Sean?
I am on Twitter at Sean022 and on Instagram at Sean Filmwriter.
Okay, and at Need a Bigger Pod is how this podcast is delivered to you, and it's distributed by Michael Marsh Production. Thank you very much to our executive producers, which are me and Paul Marsh. Give myself a pat on the back there we go. Okay, do keep watching at Need a Bigger Pod on all socials or on your favorite podcast platform. Find the Need a Bigger Pod channel. Bigger Pod? Need a Bigger Pod? I don't need a Bigger Pod. I need a smaller one. Need a Bigger Pod on all podcast platforms if you want to hear more about that, or previous episodes like the one we did with Ludvig Göransson last week, which was excellent. So if you've seen Oppenheimer since, go and check that out. We do have more guests coming up. We also have some adventures from the vaults, don't we? So there are some great interviews that we conducted over the last few months, actually. And some of them have been on the radio, and some of them over there on Express FM, and some have been featured in other ways, like they've been transcribed into magazines and so on and so forth, or we've used some parts and composer series. But for the first time ever, we have, I think, we have those interviews in their full uncut form, which will be released to Scoreheads episodes as well. So keep your ears out for those, because they're coming along next. But in the meanwhile, thank you to you, Sean. Keep listening to them soundtracks.